Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do our brains process the vast array of sounds we hear every day, and what impact do those sensations have on our moods, our actions, and our understanding of the world around us? As my guest today will explain, sound has both a physical and psychological effect on human beings, and we perceive sound waves faster than we can think and in a far broader range than the spectrum of color we can see. Seth S. Horowitz joins us now to talk about the relationship between our brains and the sounds that surround us. He's a neuroscientist and assistant research professor at Brown University, and he's author of the new book, The Universal Sense: How Hearing Shapes the Mind. Seth, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Tell us about that range of frequencies that can be perceived by human ears and human brains, and how it compares with the range afforded to us by our vision.
Well, we're mammals, so mammals are members of the high-frequency club. We have the most extraordinarily broad range of hearing. And a lot of people say, oh, your dog has better hearing than you do because it can hear up or hear that whistle that you can barely make out at all. Mm-hmm. But humans have a tremendous range compared to almost every other animal on the planet. We hear from about 20 hertz, which is the deepest bass note you can ever hear here. And yet you can also hear up to 20 kilohertz, 20,000 hertz, which when you're very young, you can hear that as a high-pitched squeal. You don't get a lot of tonal information out of it, but you do get a lot of little features that are very important to your perception. Hmm. As we get older, our high-end hearing tends to drop down, but we still hear better than almost every other vertebrate on the planet. And the range of sounds that we hear and the speed at which we hear them makes it a much faster system than our visual system. Our visual system is also excellent. We're visual animals. Like most primates, we're trichromats. We see a broad range of colors, and we're pretty good about seeing things in relatively low light levels. But what really differentiates vision from hearing is the speed at which we process it. When you think something consciously, when you recognize something, you're operating at about the speed of one major event, half a second or a second, to see something, figure out what it is, and be able to say, okay, I recognize that that's Bob.
Mm-hmm.
But you can carry out the same thing at least 10 times faster with hearing. And for many features, you hear things up to 100 times faster than you do with vision. This is largely because vision is a chemical sense. We tend to think of it as being very fast, but light has to come in, hit different types of receptors, get reassembled in the brain. It's a very synthetic sense. It puts things together, whereas hearing is mechanical. And like most mechanical things, it operates very, very rapidly. You're not going through a lot of chemical synapses and going all over the brain as you are with vision. Hearing, the pressure from the changes in the air, vibration of the air, come and physically move hair cells inside your ear. And as soon as those hair cells move, they trigger very rapid chemical change, which is picked up in 50 milliseconds, 50 thousandths of a second. That's about the speed that you can start processing and identifying sounds. Compare that with 500 milliseconds for vision.
I was interested to read that all mammals with backbones have the ability to hear. Talk about what that suggests about the importance of hearing for animal survival.
Well, all animals with backbones, not just mammals. Mammals are just sort of have the widest range of hearing. But the reason that all vertebrates probably hear is that it's a remarkably fast telesense. That's a sense that operates at a distance. We have six senses. I know everyone talks about five: vision, hearing, smell, touch, taste. But we also have the vestibular sense, which is balance. That's mm-hmm. our sixth sense, and it's related to hearing. And very early on in vertebrate development, the earliest vertebrate fossils show signs of an inner ear structure, which is very similar to the kind of inner ear that we have. And our earliest ancestors, and many vertebrates today still, have a very simple inner ear that looks like ours, but uses vibration to stimulate what we would think of as our balance system. Things like fish, tadpoles, before they become terrestrial animals, they have a little organ called the sacculus. And in terrestrial animals like us, it measures gravity because it vibrates up and down. If you're in the water, basically the water comes in, the pressure wave comes in the water, and doesn't vibrate the bone to move it around. It vibrates the whole fish, and the bone kind of sits still. So it's sort of the opposite, but it's the same basic mechanism. we've taken this early vibration sensor from when we all lived in the sea and turned it into the gravity sensor, and then from that we evolved a more elaborate thing to perceive a wider range of sounds. And that's how we went from just having a simple saccular sound detection system to having that snail shell shaped structure in our ear called the cochlea.
So, Seth, how common is it for animals with the ability to perceive sound to also use it to communicate?
Well, it's a sort of a natural progression. The thing about sound is it propagates very, very broadly and in a very distinct manner. Again, when you're talking about animals that hear underwater, which humans don't do very well, if you've ever stuck your head underneath the bathtub or gone diving, everything sort of sounds like it's coming from the same place at the same time, it's because we've evolved to hear in air. But sound travels a very, very far distance, and it travels differently based on the frequencies that are traveling through the air, that are propagating. So if you're underwater, sound travels very fast. It travels 5 times faster than it does in the air. So an animal that's underwater can be really good at detecting sounds from very far away, but unless they have special structure, it's hard for them to figure out where sound is coming from. Some fish are, in fact, hearing specialists. They have a little connection from their vertebra to their inner ear, so they have a better chance of figuring out sound comes in, hits the swim bladder, which is a big air bubble in their belly, communicates the vibration through these vertebrae to their inner ear, and it gives them a better hearing discrimination and better localization. Fish like goldfish are hearing specialists. When you come out into the air, however, the speed of sound is much slower. It's about 1,000 feet per second. What's good about this is it's a biologically relevant speed. If you're standing in the middle of a field or a clear area, you can hear almost everything from about 1 kilometer around, presuming that it's a relatively quiet area. But you can hear things from, you know, a guy playing a saxophone 1/4 mile away. You can hear people running up behind you 2 blocks away with no problem. But there are differentiation of the sound that you can hear. Low-frequency sounds will travel farther, because they have very, very long wavelengths. This is why you set up foghorns with these very deep sounds. It prevents a very unpleasant intersection of ship and rock. But high-frequency sounds tend to dissipate in the air much faster. That's why animals like bats that use extremely high-frequency sound to echolocate and actually build three-dimensional worlds with sound only have a range of about 30 feet. So it's much narrower. But our brains have evolved basically understanding at a neural level how different frequencies propagate. So you can make very fast judgments about what's the kind of sound that is, where it is, and how far away it is just by passive listening.
I was very excited to find your chapter about bullfrogs and how they use sound for mating purposes, because this is a true story. Last summer, I was on vacation with my family in Florida. We stayed very close to a little lagoon that at night was turned out to be a total meat market for frogs.
Oh, Lord.
And their calls would sort of travel in waves around this like semicircle of land. It was astonishing.
Yeah. A bullfrog chorus can be deafening. The basic way bullfrogs mate is the males are the ones who call. Some frogs the females call, but those are usually the underwater frogs. But bullfrogs, the males sit around the edge of a pond, and they start calling. And they have that very loud 90-decibel call. And it's pretty rare to find only one. You'll get a chorus. And all the males are going off, and they're trying to attract the females that might be trying to find the pond by hopping over land or swimming from one pond to another. But if you look at a frog, or if you ever see a picture of a frog brain, their brains are tiny. They're sort of like fat toothpicks. And yet they have these incredibly complicated social behaviors based on sound. And there are very specific rules. It's not just sort of like going into a bar and yelling, "Hey, baby," at the top of your lungs. The female figures out that anybody who can sit by the side of a swamp and scream their lungs out for 6 or 8 hours is probably pretty healthy. It's a lot of energy to try and call. So whoever calls the loudest, most regularly, and longest is probably reasonably fit and a good choice to pass on her genes. So the males are competing for the female's attention, and the females do what's called phonotaxis, which means orient on the right sound. The females are very good about picking out just bullfrog sounds. And the males will call, but they'll answer each other only across the pond. This is one of the rules. Since bullfrogs, they seem like little green sumos to us, but they're actually major predators for their environment. They will call, and one across the pond will also call. That's not a threat. That's just keeping the sound level up and making the level attractive. But if two males are too close to each other, and one calls and then the next calls, the males will orient on each other. And if they keep calling, they give out an aggression call, and then they fight. And it looks like two green sumos grabbing each other and trying to swallow each other's heads. And it's funny to us out there with our microphones getting bit by mosquitoes. But to them, it's deadly serious. They are, you know, trying to pass on the next generation. So the rule is don't call if you're too close. Call across the pond. But then, of course, you have the sneaky guys who may not be quite as big and brawny as the other bullfrogs. And while two bullfrogs are slugging it out next to each other, these guys won't call at all. They're just going to sit there quietly. And when the female comes over to see who wins the fight, they'll sneak out and jump on her.
So in other words, like, hey, darling, let me buy you a drink while these guys are beating each other up.
Exactly. So even if your brain's the size of a toothpick, it still wins over bronze sometimes.
What impact does the experience of sound by any individual have on the function and even the form of our brains? And now we're moving up the food chain to human beings and moving away from frogs.
Well, you have to remember, anything that you sense makes not only a behavioral change, a psychological change, but a physiological and a physical change in your brain. Neurons are not just these wires connecting this chunk of your brain, which likes this, and this chunk of your brain together. It's not like a telephone system. Neurons change physically. They reconnect. They lose connections. They undergo this basic physical modeling of something called Hebbian learning. And the shortcut for that, without getting into 2 or 3 years of grad school, is those neurons that wire together. So if, let's say, someone calls your name, you're a young kid, and you're just learning the sound of your name. And you've just come into the world, and everything's exciting and noisy, and you don't really know what's going on, but your parents say to you, Susan, you're Susan, or say, doggy, and point to the dog, and hopefully not the cat to confuse you. Every time you hear the word, and there's some association touching you or picking you up, a bunch of neurons will start saying, we have heard this before, and will strengthen the synaptic connection for those particular sounds with a specific behavior. And the next time it comes, it'll be easier to make those connections. And with every repetition, the neurons will actually reorganize themselves to reconnect so that the next iteration of that sound becomes easier. And this has a lot of effects on your life. It's not just learning your name. It's learning what sounds you like or what ads you like or what ads you hate or what music you like or hate. If you've heard a Lady Gaga sound, a piece of music, once and say, okay, I've heard that once. It comes in a second time, something about it you like. The third time it comes in, it's familiar, and you start coming up with your response a little bit quicker. Either you like it for one reason or you hate it for another, until it gets to the point that you'll either turn up the volume or you'll change the channel so you don't have to hear it again. But then, after it only gets to a few notes, it restructures how you listen with every subsequent presentation of a sound.
My guest is neuroscientist Seth S. Horowitz. He's assistant research professor at Brown University and author of the new book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Seth S. Horowitz. He's a neuroscientist and assistant research professor at Brown University. His new book is called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We left off, Seth, talking about how many of us can instantly tell if we love or hate a Lady Gaga song after we've heard it a few times. I think all of us also have had that sense that certain kinds of sounds, and music in particular, can function almost like a drug. It enhances or changes our moods. And it turns out that that's not just an emotional response, but there is a chemical response to certain sounds.
Well, remember that what we think of as mood is a very high-order cognitive thing. We're perceiving how we feel at the time, but the basis of that, what's lying under it, are vast chemical changes that happen very rapidly in our brain. And one of the things about sound, particularly when you do something as complex as music, is that since it's operating so rapidly, it's operating underneath your cognitive radar. Sound gets in and gets to emotional centers of the brain via two pathways. It gets through a very fast lower route that goes to the lower part of your brain, a much slower one that goes through the cortex, that part of the brain that you usually see in fMRI pictures when they're showing the living human brain. And that part of the pathway is checking against memory. Have you heard this before? Have you had an emotional response to it before? Do you recognize it? And it does kind of a quality control check when it gets to parts of the brain, like the amygdala, which doesn't control your emotions, but lets you know that there's a certain emotional response to this that you've had before. So when you hear something as complex as music, it brings up a lot of different features. You're going through the pathways that you've set up before. You've heard this song before, and something good was happening while it was your song. You fell in love during it, or something really bad happened when you were listening to it. Or it can go the other way. You can take something that I'm in this mood, and you will seek out a piece of music or type of sound that reinforces that to sort of tell you, yes, you have every right to do this. The chemicals underlying this are extremely complex. The neuropharmacology of emotion is a field that's enormous, and people such as Joseph Ledoux, who are studying it, have spent years working on it and printed and written many wonderful books about it. But the way it ties into sound is much more complicated. The basic pharmacology of hearing is it starts out with excitatory versus inhibitory input in the ear, and then when it projects to higher centers, that's when you start getting things like what they call the dopamine rush. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's used in many things, not just emotional response. It's used in motor response, and failure of dopaminergic cells can trigger Parkinson's, but it's also triggered and released tremendously during rewarded behaviors. And many of the targets from the auditory system give off dopamine, and it's supposed to underlie some of the things like you hear a completely wonderful piece of music and you get chills, that feeling down your back that's almost like cold. And that's supposed to be related to a dopaminergic surge. But there are other neurochemicals involved. Norepinephrine, epinephrine, which have been called adrenaline and noradrenaline in the past, depending on where you went to grad school, are also released, especially when your fight-or-flight system has been activated, something that startles you or makes you afraid or just really revs you up. People who like heavy metal are not going for the sweet melody. They're going for the energy. They're going for the loudness, the kind of thing who are just people who would walk into a noise environment would run away from it. They'd get the flight part of it. But people who are into very loud, very discordant music are getting the fight aspect of it. It's getting them feeling very aggressive and very ramped up. So there are no simple things like this piece of music will give you a dopamine surge and you will feel happy, or this one will give you an epinephrine surge and you will feel angry. It's extraordinarily complicated, and it's been one of the most complicated fields in neuroscience. And if you read a lot of neuroscience and the brain and music and the brain papers, you'll just see all kinds of contradictions depending on what lab and what theory is being operated on at the moment.
So ordinarily on this show, I am not a fan of trick questions, but having read your book, I'm going to ask you one that I think you would agree is a trick question.
Okay.
What is music?
Oh, Lord. I had, when I first started writing the book, I started assembling a list of definitions, and I was going back to the 17th century to get some of them, versus, you know, people who were would define specific keys as being full of womanly spleen or martial righteousness. Versus,
you don't hear that in Rolling Stone today. You don't read.
Not too often, but I've heard just as silly things, just with different vocabulary. You know, versus talking to neuroscientists who will describe music sometimes as a series of regular tones with a normal, with a regularized temporal pattern, which can be anything from frog calls to a conga beat. One of the best definitions I ever heard was from a friend of mine who was a sax player, who basically said, if we can play it, they can dance to it and then whistle it on the way home, that's music. It's sort of the, I don't know what it is, but I recognize it when I hear it. And that's part of the problem of science addressing something as complicated as music. It's that depending on your definition, you will get a different answer. And it can cause a lot of problems. Things such as, there was that wonderful paper that caused all this controversy called the Mozart Effect.
Oh, yeah.
And the Mozart Effect just took a piece of Mozart sonata and played it for people, and the paper just very simply claimed that listening to this particular sonata for a certain period of time gave a modest but significant increase in a certain type of IQ test report, spatial reasoning. That's all they said. But as soon as you take a scientific data point and you put it in something that's pretty well read, this was in Nature, it gets picked up by the press and the media, and it gets shortened. What may have taken you years to do the study suddenly has to fit into, if you're lucky, a five-page article, but more likely one paragraph or a headline, and it became Mozart, greatest composer ever, had secret to the brain. It was nothing like that.
Because they didn't test like AC/DC and Gangnam Style and whatever else was out there at the time.
No, but there have been subsequent studies that show that what if you listen to a piece of music that is relatively structured, that is something that you like for the same amount of time, you will see almost the same increase depending on the actual parameters of the test. It wasn't Mozart. It's music in general because it's a very structured input. There are a lot of tie-ins to parts of the brain that respond best to structured output, which is why if you listen to music, or even more so, if you practice a musical instrument, you tend to do better on spatial reasoning tasks and motor performance, which is one reason it's very important for a child to learn how to play a musical instrument. They don't have to grow up to be a musician, but get a kid and expose them into an instrument early on, and you will improve their motor skills. Just because motor output and timing, such as the timing you get from listening to music, are very tightly coupled in the brain.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chris in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are y'all doing today?
Great, thank you.
I had a question. I'm in a psychology class in college, and we're reading a bunch of books about child learning, and one of the books mentioned that the reason the Asian culture is so much better at math is because the syllables in their math words are much smaller. Is there any way we can combat that, like from hearing and learning with our English syllables and how long our words are for our mathematical numbers?
I don't know that study, and I also don't know too many Asian languages, so I can't comment too much on that. Spoken words in any language, whether it's a tonal language like Mandarin or non-tonal language like English, have very specific mathematical intervals built into them. And this is where a lot of our musical intervals come from. They actually come from speech intervals. Tying that into mathematical performance, I think, is a bit of a stretch. The intonations and speech are very related to intonation in music. But as soon as you start making multiple jumps, such as length of syllables, cross-cultural studies, and performance, educational performance, you're getting pretty far away from the original source. I would want to read the original paper before I'd worry too much about that.
What accounts, Seth, for the remarkable memory human beings have for melody, even those of us who haven't had all those music lessons as kids and aren't particularly good at making music ourselves?
It's probably because sound happens so quickly that it gets into all the basal levels of the brain really fast, and so it can be repeated. We all get earworms. I'm currently suffering from one myself because, you know, we're up in the at the very edge of the hurricane zone, and we have some refugees from New Jersey with their young baby, and they sing him baby songs, which are very consonant. There's not a rough note in there anyway, so they're very easy to repeat. They're intervals that we can all repeat in our brains, or we could sing, and so they're very easy to just break into new loops, and they get repeated over and over again, and so they stick.
Let me interrupt. That's what an earworm is, when a song gets stuck in your head.
And they can, what you find with most earworms, which ties into your question of about why can we remember it so well, is that you get these loops, and the loops tend to be things that are very consonant, which means that they're easy to process, and you know they don't have a lot of dissonance between closely related notes. They tend to get repeated at what I call human-enabled rhythms, which means that you're not thrashing them. They're not coming out at 64th notes. It's something that you could tap out with your hand or tap with your foot. If you combined relatively slow, regular timing and consonant sounds, it's really easy for things to get into loops and then get stuck. Because once you hear it, and maybe you hum it to yourself, and all of a sudden, it's sort of like revving a motor. It just keeps going. And the worst I ever had was a 3 to 5 day loop of something by Bruce Springsteen.
And is there any cure for that?
There are a lot of different possible cures for it. I mean, the first cure I ever read about was written by Mark Twain, who wrote a story about getting a ticket seller's chant stuck in his head. It was called Punch Brother. And it was just this repetitive thing that the ticket sellers on the train used to say, where they were giving out the color of the ticket and the price of it, and they said it in a sing-song. And he described hearing it and it getting stuck in his head. And the only way he was able to get rid of it was by teaching it to somebody else, so that they picked it up like a virus. There are other ways to get around it. Another thing is play another sound that could interrupt the earworm and just keep playing it over and over louder than it's going in your head. But then you run the risk of that becoming an earworm.
Right.
Another one that a friend suggested to me, and I haven't tried out yet, but it's sort of interesting from a sensory level. He uses very hot, red hot candies, something that's very, very spicy and very flavorful. And I could, you never think about interaction between taste and hearing, but almost any sensory interruption might break up the loop. So putting something very spicy in your mouth, like a raw habanero, would probably get the earworm out of your head, but then you have other issues.
It is. I think they're the worst of all when you can't remember all the lyrics, and so you can't finish the song. I remember reading somewhere that if you listened to or sang out the entire melody, that little phrase would go away.
I haven't tried that. I would suspect that you might just really strengthen the loop. There are some things you're just doomed to do.
Talk about this. How are we affected by the absence of sound, just the presence of quiet?
The presence of quiet is really rare, and we may think that we're surrounded by quiet, but it's really unusual. It's just that our brains are really good at damping out extraneous material, and part of that is that you don't usually pay attention to sound. Sound is what drives your attention to other things. And so when I lived in New York, I lived in Brooklyn, right near an elevated subway train, and yet I got along, didn't have trouble hearing my wife talking to me from the other room. And yet, when I did measure it, it was about 72 decibels, which is, even with the windows closed and the train not going by, it was a loud city street. I thought of that as quiet.
Wow.
Then I moved to Rhode Island and a very rural area in it, and now I'm in a semi-rural zone, and it'll be 48 decibels, which, you know, going from 72 to 48 doesn't sound a lot, but what you're talking about is a logarithmic rating of pressure. So we're talking thousands of times quieter. And it was so quiet, it used to bug me. I couldn't sleep.
Hmm.
You know, the cricket would go off, and all of a sudden it would be like somebody shooting a gun off outside my window because all of a sudden there's a sound. Your brain responds to sound, to silence. If you play sounds to people and they're in a neural imaging system or you have an EEG running on them, the gap between one sound and the next, especially if you lengthen it, the neurons that were responding suddenly start synchronizing as if they're getting ready for the next input. And if the sound goes out on too long, you can see a lot of neurons ganging up and cycling together as if they're going, like, what's going to happen next? It's almost a neural level of a horror movie.
Hmm.
So as much as we say we like silence, there really isn't silence. There's just relatively quiet. The only place you might find true silence would be an anechoic lab, either at a university that studies hearing or a place that designs speakers and sound systems. And it's usually very disturbing to people because you walk into this room. When I worked in the bat lab, the walls were covered with acoustic foam. The floor was carpeted deeply, and so was the ceiling. There were these baffles to set up sound because we had to fly bats in there, and we're using microphones to pick up these very quiet ultrasonic sounds. But if you went in and didn't turn all the computers, whose fan noise I always found annoying, the sound level would be just about the minimum you could possibly measure. And at first you just enjoy the quiet, and then you start talking to yourself just to hear something. Because if you're quiet, you can actually hear the sound of air molecules banging around in your ear canal.
Wow.
And it's Brownian noise. And then a few minutes after that, you start hearing your own heartbeat. And that gets really unnerving to most people. It takes a while to learn to appreciate it. So we all say, I could use some silence, but unless you're dead, you're deaf, or you're stuck in outer space, in which case the first two probably apply, there is no silence on Earth.
Seth S. Horowitz is my guest. He's a neuroscientist and assistant research professor at Brown University. We're talking about his new book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neuroscientist Seth S. Horowitz, author of the new book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. I want to talk about the, undervalued ability that we human beings have to tune out certain noises. My husband and I joke that nobody under 40 can hear the noise our dishwasher and our dryer make when they're done cycling, because it's very important to us that those things get emptied. But to our kids, they're not so important, and they tune those things out. But in fact, the ability to tune out unwanted sounds is really helpful, right?
It's extraordinarily important because we're constantly surrounded by sound. If you didn't tune it out, you'd probably be overwhelmed very rapidly by it. And there are some conditions in which people can't filter out noise, and they really have significant cognitive problems. There's some speculation that some forms of autism, or the autistic spectrum disorders, are triggered by the inability to filter out environmental sound. So you have mechanisms in place all the way from your ear, all the way through your brain, to basically shut things down. Sound is supposed to be your early warning system. It's what goes on behind your vision. It even works when you're asleep. So you have to have some way of saying, okay, tune it down, unless something jumps out and says, you better wake up and look to your right because something's going to eat you. But you have a mechanism that, for example, the most basic one, when you talk, if you didn't have something to reduce the volume inside your head, when you talked, it would be deafening in there, especially if you were yelling or singing. But you have a mechanism that just before you start speaking, the tympanic tensor pulls down on your eardrum and reduces the volume so that you don't hear the sound getting out into the world quite so loudly getting into your head, because you're picking up quite a bit of it through your skull. So that's a really basic mechanism, but there's also a neural mechanism. If something is chronically loud, if you're living in my old neighborhood in Brooklyn, your brain will just literally tune down the gain on the system and say, this is normal background sound. You're not only going to not pay as much attention to it, which is a higher order function, but you're going to reduce how much you process it and make it quieter, so anything that's important, like someone yelling your name, or the sound of the front door opening, or the sound of the dishwasher overflowing and hearing quiet bubbles over the train sound, that'll jump out. But it's really important to be able to do this. But, you know, there is another feature of what you described. Like you're saying, you know, your kids can't hear this sound because they're tuning it out cognitively. But there's also a difference as you get older what you tune into. As we all get older, we all tend to focus on lower frequency sounds. And I have found that I will hear things like the dishwasher or a truck going by better than kids. And I don't know if it's attentional disorder or the fact that my high frequency hearing is undergoing the normal aging process. I'm losing it. And the rest of your hearing expands to where you're used to hear high frequency sounds. So you're constantly changing the gain of things that are important and available just as you progress throughout your life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes. My question for Dr. Horowitz is perhaps ill-formed. I'm curious, does the neuroscience on hearing, is it giving us any insights into the emergence of auditory hallucinations in psychotic disorders, whether they might be an auditory deficiency contributing to it, or it's an effect of a more global cognitive decline?
What do you know about that, Seth?
It's not my field of specialty, but I do know that there are a couple of very interesting theories that I've sort of looked at. Auditory hallucinations themselves are really interesting because it's a complex thing. People will hear voices, or they will hear music, or they'll hear just, you know, if you hear just tones, it's usually categorized as tinnitus, although there are auditory hallucinations that are just simple sounds. And one of the theories that I find personally most interesting, but I don't know if it's the one that's the hottest in the field, is the idea that it's a failure of attentional mechanisms. We all have conversations with ourselves. I know that I talk to myself in my head all the time, usually saying, did you do this? Did you do that? Where did I put this? And I don't say it out loud because my wife would look at me funny. But I know that this is my voice, and so I'm not paying attention to it the same way as I would an external stimulus. One of the theories for certain dementias is that you lose, it's not an auditory disorder, but it's an attentional disorder. You can no longer differentiate internal states from external sensory input, so that it may just be that the voice in your head is the same voices that we all have in our head as we're talking to ourselves or thinking something out loud in our head, and you just can't differentiate that voice was not said to you by the dog or the rock or the invisible person. I'm sorry, I can't answer in more detail. It's just not my field.
Let's talk about the use of sound in law enforcement or even as a weapon of war. This is something people have been talking about for a long time. We hear that when someone's barricaded in a house, occasionally they'll have like really horrific sounding music piped in. How effective is this really?
We've been using sound as sort of a psychological weapon for many, many years. I mean, one of the oldest stories is, you know, Joshua at Jericho, which was supposed to have been massed horns blowing down the walls. Sound doesn't work too well as a physical weapon. There are certain types of sound which can have physical effects on a body, but in order for a sound to have a physical effect, the power levels are going to make your psychological state kind of irrelevant. It'll do bad things to you physically first. At a psychological level, loud sound is bad. Anything that's above, let's say, 90 decibels is already getting into the point where exposure to it for more than a brief time can cause physical damage to your hearing. It will unlodge hair cells, and it will give you temporary shifts in your hearing. When you start getting up around 120 decibels, which is usual model is a gunshot going off near your head, you're causing physical damage that can be permanent to your hearing. But when you hear about things like the LRAD is a long-range acoustic device. And what it is, it's a focused emitter, and it doesn't put out anything too fancy. It puts out a 2,000 hertz tone, which is the high end of your best hearing range. But it's pumping out a tremendous amount of power. Anything that low gets right into you, that powerful and that loud, gets right into your brainstem and says, this is something you need to move away from. There'll be a reflexive covering of your ears, but if it's over 120 decibels, and these things often are, it's covering your ears doesn't help much. You just want to run away, and that's what these things were designed for. And if you were to play 120 decibel sound from a normal speaker, like I made the mistake of going to the Black and Blue, the Black Sabbath Blue Oyster Cult concert in New York in the 1980s and sat right in front of the speakers, and I really should have just run away. But my hearing was shot for a good 6-8 hours.
Hmm.
But anyone who was 10 feet to my right or left wouldn't have been affected as much because sound just propagates spherically from that. The thing about devices like the LRAD is the sound is focused. So it doesn't get quieter at the same rate that normal sound does. So it can be dangerous to be in front of for 50 to 100 feet. There are a lot of other weapons that get discussed, but most of them, frankly, are science fiction. You're not going to see the decibel bullets that they used in a lot of science fiction movies, and playing ultrasonic sounds at people, no matter how loud, really aren't going to do that much. High-powered ultrasound is great for blowing apart kidney stones and warming up your muscles, but you're talking millions of cycles per second put right up against the tissue and usually with a conductive gel. The psychological effects of sound can be profound, can make you run away, can make you very fearful, but they can also work the other way. Sometimes a loud sound can work to attract people. That's why some stores who are catering to a younger clientele or a bar or a club that wants young people to come in has a sound up at what would be considered dangerous levels.
Hmm.
You know, I'm not going to walk into Abercrombie & Fitch when their store music is 90 decibels, but my friend's kids who are 14 and 15 years old, they go in, and what would be aversive to me is energizing to them. But it's still stressful, and it's clever because this stress makes people want to do things like gather resources to be safe, which translates in humans into shopping, spending money.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Diane in Dallas. Hey, Diane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about sort of relating to the question of tuning out different noises. I find that I am very irrationally annoyed by the sound of people like popping gum or chomping gum or things like that in the background. It seem to be noises that a lot of times people can tune out, and I sometimes can tune them out, but it's driven me crazy since I was a kid. And I know that I'm not the only one, because apparently my grandmother did the same thing, and I'm not on the autism spectrum or diagnosed with a psychotic disorder. But I'm wondering why those sounds like that seem to be less or more easy for some people to sort of put into the background, whereas other people attend to them very much more.
Yeah, it doesn't require having any kind of disorder. It's just some sounds are reacted to more or less by some people. I have a good friend that if I ever want to drive him crazy, all I have to do is flap my lips or chew with my mouth open. And he goes up like a fingernails on the blackboard time for him. If it was a general condition and all sounds bothered you, it would be called misophonia. It's just hyperreaction. But organic sounds trigger people a lot. And it can be lip smacking or belching or just somebody murmuring in the background. Organic sounds, human sounds, whether speech or biological sounds, tend to be those right in the middle of our most sensitive hearing range. And if this is something that you've heard and didn't like it the first time, and you're going to keep hearing it because these are human sounds, once you start disliking a sound, it's really hard to shift emotional response to it. And since it sounds that you hear very easily, because it's right in your best hearing range, it can keep going. And also, as you get older, in particular, this may get worse because your hearing range starts restricting. So you can't necessarily be distracted by other environmental sounds. You start getting these lower frequency, deep lip smack or belching sounds, and they just get right into your ear, go right to your brain, and you go, ew.
Is there something special about the fingernails on a chalkboard sound that it really taps into something we hate?
It's such a universally loathed sound. I always wished it had been studied more. There's only one good paper on it, and that was by Halpern and colleagues in 1986 with the great title of The Psychoacoustics of a Chilling Sound.
Hmm.
And what they did was they took recordings of fingernails on blackboards and metal rake on concrete, which is my worst, or people rubbing balloons. I think it was rubbing styrofoam on balloons. And they had people rate them how much you like this, how much you hate this. And what they found was, yeah, these are really horrible sounds, and everybody seems to hate them. And their hypothesis at the time was that it was the frequency which included some of the type of sounds included in all primate alarm calls, screaming babies, screaming baby monkeys. And so it was looked at as sort of an evolutionary thing. I got to do this with a student recently to re-look at it. And what we looked at was not the frequency content, but the fine changes in the time, the temporal structure of the sound. If you think about fingernails on a blackboard or a rake on concrete, what you get is something that binds and then clicks, and then binds and then clicks, but it doesn't do it very, very temporally. It doesn't do it very smoothly. You've got this kind of pseudo-random clicking sound. And we found that if you took the pseudo-random envelope, the shape of the sound, and slapped it over anything from music to voice, you could start getting the fingernail on the blackboard effect out of it. Now, the student took off before we got to publish it, but the data is really interesting, and what it looks like is it's not the frequency. It's the fine temporal structure of the sound, and the only time you'll ever see that kind of structure to the sound is when someone's screaming their lungs out. So it's not so much that baby screaming. When you talk or you sing or communication, your vocal apparatus makes very harmonic sounds, a very normal mathematical relationship. When you start screaming, all the little wet bits in your vocal apparatus start flapping out of control. So it's probably that we're hardwired to know that something that should be harmonic suddenly going pseudo-random means somebody is screaming out of control. It's sort of the flip side of an alarm call. It's not the tone. It's the way the tone is structured over time. So fingernails on a blackboard gets right to your brain and says, someone is screaming their lungs out. This is probably bad.
We just have about half a minute left, Seth, but you write about the fact that where other people take snapshots, you and your wife collect audio recordings on trips. The moment I read that, it struck me as something we all ought to be doing.
I love doing it, and we just always go with too much auditory gear with us, catacombs of Paris to recording wherever we go. I wanted to put a digital recorder up on the roof during the hurricane, but I got talked out of that one.
Well, I'm glad that you're safe, and your equipment is safe too as well, I gather.
That's the important part, because it's expensive and I'll heal.
Seth S. Horowitz is a neuroscientist and assistant research professor at Brown University. His new book is called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. Seth, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Janine Kamash answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.